I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, Jacob Saul, is a member of an exclusive club. These are individuals who get a phone call out of the blue from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, informing them that they are a fellow and a recipient of a sizable grant, no strings attached. Saul got that phone call last week, one of just 22 winners this year. He was praised for his scholarship on the cultural and intellectual history of early modern Europe. Saul told the American Historical Association that he was going to spend his $500,000 on, quote, wine and old-time learning. I want to hide out in Paris in old libraries, he said, take notes, sleep on my desk, write books, and see odd movies in little theaters. History, he says, is about having time to think, meander, find strange connections, and follow improbable leads. Well, that sounds like fun. We've asked Jacob Saul to join us on Radio Times to talk about his work, how it informs current events, and of course, his award, and he's a professor of history at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey. And Jacob Saul, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations.
Thanks, Marty. It's nice to be here. I'm a big fan.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate that. And this is always the question you ask a MacArthur Fellow, where were you when you got this phone call? And I guess it was a week ago.
Actually, no, it was a couple weeks ago.
A couple weeks ago.
You have
ago.
To keep the secret. Oh. And I was walking in the rain, actually going to a library on the Penn campus, and I was worrying about how I was going to continue my research, and I got this call, and I didn't believe it. I just didn't believe it.
Well, how could you, right?
I thought it was a joke, and I was actually, you know, I was like, no, I really don't need this right now. I don't need this joke.
And what do they actually say?
You know, they come on, and they ask you where you are, and if you can sit down, and if you know what the, you know, the MacArthur Foundation is, and that's when you say, okay, look, you know. And then they sort of slowly tell you that you've gotten the grant. And then you kind of freak out. And they give you a number. And they say, you know, you can call us back. So, you know, I Googled the number on my iPhone, called them back. And then I was like, oh, my God.
And then you believed it.
At the moment, I was sort of in shock, yeah.
So when you say freak out, meaning just how could this possibly have happened to me?
Yeah, you go into shock, you know. You're literally in shock. You're like, this. It's sort of hard to digest mentally. So, yeah.
And is it the honor of the award? I mean, often called the Genius Award. I don't know if you're comfortable with that or not. And it does come with a lot of money, no strings attached.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, look, obviously the money's fantastic and that changes things. But when you get the award, you know that everything's going to change. The award itself is like a tidal wave. And especially if you've been struggling in your work or you feel like you've had to make your case. And this makes the case for you. Right. And that's, I mean, that I don't feel like I have to keep doing it, at least right now.
And not to be dramatic here, but you were literally just sort of struggling with, can I continue to pursue this intellectual history that I'm interested in?
Yeah. I mean, I've got all these projects. They're expensive. You've got to travel all the time. You have to buy books. You have to go to these countries. You have to research constantly. It's not that easy to do. And the more sort of ambitious and strange it gets, I mean, each time you find a lead, you have to follow it. And so then you say, gosh, now I need more funds for this, or I need time. And so, yeah, it's perfect.
And what have been the responses of your colleagues?
They've been great. You know, I mean, they have been great. It's not that, you know, it's not, I have for years picked up the paper and seen the MacArthur grants and gone, well, whatever, you know.
mean, what makes them so great,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Who are these people? And so I get it, you know. But, you know, it's good for our campus. It's great. It's good for our students. I think they're into it, and it makes them feel appreciated, too. And that's great. It's great. It's good for our university. And it's also just good for the cause of research. This is a grant which, at least when they explained it to me, was for my research.
Right.
And so it's the recognition of the nuts and bolts work.
And for you, quoting you, history is about having time to think, meander, find strange connections, and follow improbable leads. That's what history has been for you?
Yeah. I spent a lot of time living in Paris when I was working on this stuff, also working in other jobs, and I did meander for years through the libraries and the archives, and that's how I made the connections. And it was a very human experience. And also, it's kind of like literature. You know, you live these things and you follow them. You get to know these people who are dead.
Yes. But had lived in this place, right? So there's sort of entrails of these people. Right.
And you start sniffing it out, and the beauty of it is when you get to know it well enough, and that's why you have to hang out and you have to spend time, is you get an instinct, and sometimes you say, you know, I know that this book or this document is there. I know what this is going to say. And weeks later, you find it, and it's there, and you said, I did it. I did some time travel, and that's a super cool feeling.
I do want to talk about your work because it's both heady and very interesting and I think has some relevance for the world that we live in today. But you and I were talking about your experiences in school, and I think anyone listening to this conversation will feel heartened to some degree that you can be a MacArthur Fellow and be tossed out of high school.
I can't remember even if it was junior high or high school. I blocked it all out. But yeah, you know, I was a troublemaking student, you know, it didn't fit me very well, although everyone should do well in high school and work hard. Right. I mean, I know that now. But it wasn't for me. The format wasn't for me. And I got sent from Cambridge, Massachusetts to Iowa City, and that was intense.
To public school, like that?
Yeah, and I was shining in one way. I was in detention most of the time. I was always reading. I was always reading books from the 17th century. I was always reading historical books. I sort of always did do this. I mean, this was something I've always done. But yeah, it was really hard, you know. And then I got into the University of Iowa State School, but back then they let anybody in. And then I had a mentor there who had gone to Central High in Philly, who knew my dad.
Oh, wow.
And he knew that I read history books in my walk-in closet, which was filled with books. And he started reading history with me sort of on the side, and then I decided that I liked that, and I liked college a lot because that's what you did and that was cool, and that worked and it sort of took off.
Do you think you were bored in school? I mean, as you said, you were a troublemaker. Was the work hard for you? It wasn't interesting to you?
I mean, I think I had some kind of learning disability.
Do you?
Yeah. I mean, it made me extremely anxious. When I look back, I think I would have done better on a vineyard making wine. I mean, that's what.
Or Votech kind of, like hands-on
I don't know,
kind of
something
stuff?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, it all worked out now, so maybe this was the right path. I don't know. I don't know. It wasn't that much fun while I was doing that part of it. But I also got to go to Europe a lot, and that kind of changed things for me. I mean, I lived there a long time, and that also sort of inspired me, and I wanted more of it, and so I knew I had to work to get back there. And so,
did you frustrate your teachers, though? I mean, to be sent to detention the time?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, did they think you were smart and you just weren't working hard, weren't applying yourself, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, you know, I apologize to them today for being like, I still feel
that perhaps it was worth it.
I feel bad about
eventually.
It, but, you know, I mean, I guess it's just not for everybody, the format, but, yeah.
I'm not trying to belabor this, but I just, and it's not to indict schools or teachers or anything like that, but I can't tell you how many people I've interviewed who have struggled through school and through perhaps a mentor, an experience, something that happens or whatever, maybe even the hard work that finally pays off, they're able to make something out of what was such a difficult time in their life.
Yeah, let me first say my wife is a high school teacher and she teaches, you know, Agnes Irwin on the main line, and that seems to be a wonderful place and it has the kind of openness, but as we know, it's a very exclusive place and it's not for everybody. It wouldn't have been for me. I do think absolutely that if you're an outsider, you always look at things with a different eye. And for the moment, I still have that eye because until a couple weeks ago,
you were an outsider.
Definitely an outsider. And so that has been my methodology. And it hasn't always made me friends because you see something and you say, oh, that's nonsense. I can see exactly what you're up to because I didn't come through the system and I see how it fits into the system. So I guess in the sciences where you have, you know, you have a model or a paradigm, and you smash it. You smash it with a laser, with a hammer, however you can. That is sort of how I approach doing history. I see something, I don't believe it, and I zap it, and I zap it, and I zap it until it comes apart, and I can see how it works.
Interesting you had some, I mean, perhaps a mentor or certainly someone that saw that you had an interest and then helped you nurture that interest.
Absolutely. Alan Spitzer, who went to Central High, and was a friend of my dad's because my dad went to Central. And my dad went to him and said, I have a problem. You know, my son is failing out of high school, but he sits around reading French history. You know, that's a little disturbing.
Right.
And so my last sort of, you know, years of high school, I'd go to his house, we'd read history. And then I went to the university, and he was a really tough grader. Yeah. And there was no nonsense. And that was good. I really liked that.
And what was your interest in French history as a young person?
Absolutely. I was sort of stunned by France. I always have been, although Italy has kind of creeped up, which I think is fair enough, you know. But yeah, it's not a hard sell, you know, thinking that France is amazing and beautiful and staggering, and that its history is, you know, Italy and France. I don't even separate them. Italy, France, and Spain and a few other countries have this incredible story, which begins with the Greeks and Romans and just keeps going.
And what is that story? And I know this is the kind of nub of your work, but what is that story?
I mean, there are a whole bunch of stories. The story that I really, that fascinates me is the growth of the state, the development of politics, and how political liberty somehow comes out of this. It is not something you make or create quickly. It grows in these places, you know, England and then also Scandinavia, but in Western Europe, really, no question. And it's a long, crazy story. And I like political liberty a lot. And so when you're where it grew and where it came from, I said, look, I want to understand this on the ground. And so,
and not to be too definitional here, but when you mean, I mean, I think we would all love political liberty. Is there something that you love especially about it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, modern liberal democracy. I can say, you know, I hate the government. I'm not going to get arrested. You're free to complain and scream and do what you want. I mean, at least one hopes they are. And that's it. So, and there are obviously other measures of liberty all the time. They're shifting, they're changing, they're being redefined. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, these things are a big deal. And they seem to me very new and fragile. And there's been a long, long struggle over them.
And that has taken you to Italy, to France, I guess to the Enlightenment, to the Renaissance, to understand where these ideas came from?
Absolutely. I mean, there were, you know, people came up with these ideas. They didn't come out of nowhere. And so, first you have to go back to, you always have to go back to ancient Greece. You just have to. It's all there. You've got to move through Rome. You don't understand anything if you don't move through Rome. In fact, everybody should learn Latin. I mean, really, seriously, it's all, everything we do here, from our constitution to our buildings to our schools, it all comes from Latin tradition. And then there are these struggles. They begin within the church. They go into the Renaissance in Florence. And then they go into these palaces and parliaments and streets and back alleys. And these fights are fought. And it's a passionate story.
Well, we'll pick up on that passionate story. Jacob Saul is our guest on Radio Times. He's a professor of history at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey, and a recipient this year of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Award, the so-called Genius Award. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Westtown School. Since 1799, Westtown has invited students pre-K through 12th grade to pursue a global education, one that helps prepare them not only for college and career, but also for life. Parents who want challenging academics and character development for their child can learn more by attending Westtown's lower and middle school open house Monday, October 10th at 8:30 a.m. Details at westtown.edu.
Imagine, if you will, listening to all your favorite WHYY FM programs without membership breaks, but knowing you support public media. Introducing YStream, a pledge-free stream of WHYY FM available during our October member campaign. Visit WHYY.org by October 12th, pledge $60, and receive your special link to listen to regular WHYY FM programs during our October fund drive. Need more information? Visit WHYY.org.
Medford Lees proudly supports WHYY, a Quaker-related, not-for-profit community celebrating 40 years of service. Medford Lees offers two campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, featuring arboretum settings, residential home designs ranging from townhouses to garden-style apartments, varied contract options, a self-governing residence association, and comprehensive on-site wellness and health services. Further details at 800-331-4302 or medfordlees.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Our guest, Rutgers history professor Jacob Saul, received word this month that he was selected as a 2011 MacArthur Fellow. The honor, which recognizes creative accomplishments in a variety of fields, is known as the Genius Grant. It comes with an unrestricted $500,000 grant over 5 years. And Jacob Saul is a professor of history at Rutgers University in Camden. As I said, his scholarly work focuses on the cultural and intellectual history of modern Europe. Well, let's talk about then this Louis XIV that I think many people will be familiar with, but his finance minister, a man named Jean-Baptiste Colbert. What was their relationship about?
They had a funny Colbert is the guy that built Versailles. It's in his papers. He got the money for it. He talked to the architects. I mean, Versailles is a staggering, staggering place if anybody's been there, or you can just see it. If you go there, it really does stick with people. I mean, and it stuck with everybody at the time. It became the defining building of its age. But what happened is Louis XIV becomes king. He's young. There's been a lot of chaos. And when his sort of godfather, former prime minister, dies, who is a cardinal, he said, look, I leave you this guy. He's really competent. You'll need him. And Colbert was an accountant. He was trained as an accountant. And so Colbert comes in, and Louis does not have much money. He's the king, but all these sort of nobles have all the money. He says, I need money, and so, which is a familiar refrain,
it
right?
It sure is.
And so he said, you've got to help me, and Colbert's the guy, and he starts going through all the documents. He goes through the books, sees who owes Louis money, how he can raise taxes, how he can get more revenue, what industries he can build. But more interesting, Louis says, wow, this is amazing. I want to learn accounting. Now, that's unbelievable, because Louis was a Catholic monarch. He was not ever supposed to deal with money. He was never supposed to count money. This was considered not only low, but possibly sinful. And so in secret, Colbert teaches Louis XIV accounting. And Louis XIV writes his mother, Anne of Austria, and says, this is amazing. I'm learning accounting straight from a Florentine manual, which Colbert transcribes himself for the king. But even more, so that I find this in the archives, and this is kind of, it's floating. People sort of know about it. They had never picked it up. And I was like, boy, that's unusual. That's the first time that this has happened. So I keep looking into it, and I keep digging. And then I see when Colbert dies, well, I find that Colbert has these golden account books that Louis carries in his pocket.
Literally, in his pocket.
Literally. They're beautiful. They're made by the greatest calligrapher in gold ink. They're amazing. They're incredibly beautiful. And, the Sun King had these in his pocket, and that's not what one would have expected in his love life in Versailles, his religious beliefs, his wars. This is what he carried. When Colbert dies, he stops the account books, and he destroys the accounting system which Colbert was building.
Wow. And goes down with it, in a sense, or?
I would say yes. I mean, Louis does some incredible diplomacy, but after Colbert's death, it's really downhill for Louis XIV for a long time. And when he dies, France is not technically bankrupt, but it's almost bankrupt. And it's clear why Louis doesn't want the books done, because it's all bad news. And he's the king. He's the God made him king. He doesn't have to face this stuff, and he doesn't.
There's also a section, I guess, about double entry bookkeeping, and you're talking to someone who could, I balance my checkbook. That's about the extent
of
it.
Wow, good.
I feel pretty good about that, actually. But so why is that significant, the idea of double entry bookkeeping?
Double entry bookkeeping is the only tool to accurately keep accounts. It's harder than single entry bookkeeping. You have to record your debits and your credits in different categories, and they both have to add up to the same thing, the money that comes in and the money that comes out, and you have to verify that it's the same amount. You also have to bring all sorts of other numbers in at the same time, and it allows you to keep multiple books more effectively. the hardest part after the mathematics is the personal discipline and the will, and that is where people get into trouble.
Well, and it's hard not to segue from, you know, Louis Colbert, Versailles, this time, to our own Wall Street implosion of a couple of years ago, what we're observing across Europe, of course, as well. Do you see that connection?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first thing that struck me, and I'm writing a book about it right now, which is that Louis didn't want to face it. And we're having...
It meaning you've got money problems, right?
Money problems, but he didn't want to face his books. He kind of knew that he had money problems, but facing the books means facing every decision that you make. And as the financial crisis has gone on, and this isn't just the last 3 years, obviously, this has been going on for a long, long time, I read and listen to, and I don't actually watch much television, but I look at a lot of news sources from newspapers around the world. I never see this discussed. I read financial histories. Accounting, you know, it's sort of boring and dull, and yet when the S&P 500 supposedly makes a $2 trillion error, and then no one says, hey, let's look at these numbers, let's look at your calculations. I thought that after that, the Wall Street Journal would publish their calculations or ask for them. There were no numbers in the paper. And I couldn't believe that because this was all about numbers. So there's no, we don't have a culture of looking at this stuff, and yet it's essential, and we know that. There's a history, and Louis XIV is one of these people who tells us why we have so many problems with it. It's been a problem from the beginning. We don't, as humans, like to do this.
I had a little embarrassing revelation as I was reading your work, looking at this notion of an accountant. And, of course, that leads us to the word accountability. And it's sort of a duh moment, but nonetheless, it's hard to separate those two.
There are arguments about where the English word accountability comes from. The archivist of the British Parliament believes, and I believe it with him, that it comes from a translation of the French word comptabilité, which just means accounting. And so in English, they had always called accounting a comptabilité, just an old French word that gets stretched out. And that's sort of how it happens. And that does not enter into the English language until late. And during the French Revolution in the late 18th century. So, I mean, we don't even have the word. By the way, that Latin countries don't have the word accountability. They have the word responsibility.
Oh, that's interesting. Interesting. But just to focus on current day, the current day crisis, I mean, obviously we have, there was greed, there was incompetence, there was hiding risk, there was, in a sense, cooking the books. I mean, the list is really endless. That's what struck you as well, which is how do we get ourselves into this terrible mess.
Wall Street's filled with accountants, right? This everybody, they go to Wharton, they go to, they do their MBAs. You work for a small business, you know how to keep books. Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, all their books were bad. There's just no way that happens on its own.
Right.
The people who were supposed to be regulating this, their job is supposed to be to look at the books. They know how to do it. They know the risks that were in the bundles. I mean, it's...
When they bundled all those mortgage securities,
They bundle mortgage securities. They're bundling things that are risks. It's also just the basis of futures and derivatives that you're starting to count future earnings as present capital. That's always existed. But even the the Renaissance writers say, really be careful with that. You might want to only count what you have. Now, you can't take risks and invest properly without modern business accounting, but you have to take those risks into account. What startles me is not only the government, but most of all, the public just was clueless about this stuff. And the newspapers, I mean, I read them. The Wall Street Journal, where were they? Where were they? They complain now. Their editorial page complains and complains and complains. They haven't done work. And they didn't see this coming, as Queen Elizabeth was the only person who said that, which is an odd thing that she said that. But this is a problem that we have culturally, and it's still with us, and nothing has been done about it.
Do you think it's innumeracy? I mean, a kind of illiteracy about numbers, or we don't know how to, you know, personally connect with these kinds of figures?
I mean, if you talk to someone who grew up in the Great Depression or was the child of someone who grew up in the Great Depression, they usually keep books. My generation, you know, between the age of 22 and 42, an ambiguous generation, we don't keep books very well. We don't sort of think about it. The credit card generation, it's all done online for you, kind of, but you don't have to look at it if you don't want to until you get into trouble. And then you get into trouble.
Yes.
I think it's a cultural thing. There are a lot of accountants out there. A lot of people went to business school. But I think it's a question of what we decide to focus on and talk about. In Renaissance Florence, people talked about this. In 17th and 18th century England, people talked about this stuff. And in Holland, everybody knew how to do it. And they talked about it.
Hmm. That's Jacob Saul, our guest today on Radio Times. Recently found out that he was a MacArthur Fellow, the so-called Genius Award given out every year to an interesting, often diverse collection of Americans, recognizing the originality and dedication of their work. The foundation praised Saul's meticulous research into how modern governments came to be. We are talking about that. And he's a professor of history at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey. Any questions or comments you might have, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I know you also have an interest in Machiavelli.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's a connection between what we've been talking about or not. But
yeah, I mean, Machiavelli's the inventor of political science. I mean, with a couple ancients, Livy and Tacitus, he invents this idea that you look behind the veil, you see the motives behind things, you're critical of politics. And the method for understanding motives and politics and how they work and how you can watch out for what might come down the road in the future is by reading history. Mm-hmm. And that's a basic practice of the Renaissance. And so the idea is, if you want to stay out of trouble, or you want to dominate a city, or you want to, live under a dictator or avoid a dictator, the best way is to master the history of politics and to get political experience. Those lessons seem pretty simple, but once again, we forget them pretty quickly, and they're not that different from the lessons of accounting and accountability. I'm still looking for a connection between Machiavelli and the numbers. I haven't found it, but I know that the people who were thinking about these things were connected. But Machiavelli's the founder. I mean, he really is. And The Prince is such a big book.
I looked up Machiavellian in my American Heritage Dictionary. The quote here, or the definition, denies the relevance of morality in politics and justifies craft and deceit. And we often use that word. Someone is Machiavellian. We are oftentimes criticizing them. Is that fair?
No, not historically. He was showing the methods that princes use. It is pretty obvious that he was... the book wasn't meant to be published, but he did write...
This was The Prince,
The Prince was a manuscript book sent to the Medici, who had just overthrown the Florentine Republic. And it's not totally clear what the book is for, but I think now we know. I mean, Machiavelli was one of the leaders of the Republic. He didn't like dictatorship. And this book exposes the methods of a dictator. That's why it was banned. Not just because it taught how to be a dictator, but because even today, when my students read it, they go, wow, this is harsh stuff. And yet, I say, yeah, take note of it. It might help you, it might help you out. So it's a complicated book. Machiavelli, however, was not an immoral guy. This is the guy who stood on the walls as Florence was being attacked, who fought to the last, who was tortured for defending Republican values.
So why do you think it's taken on this sort of darker cast?
Well, he says a lot of dark stuff that no one had ever said out loud before. Cicero had always said, you have to be prudent, but you also have to be good. And Machiavelli said, no, prudence, which is a virtue, means fighting the bad winds of fortune. And to fight fortune, you got to be tough. You might have to crush your enemies. You might have to crush your friends. and you're going to have to do all these tough things. And if you really want to fight for good fortune, you're going to have to do this. You have to be realistic and live on earth. So this is the beginning of a secular description of how to survive and to build functioning Republican states.
And change the way we think about governments and how, I guess, people stay in and out of power.
Absolutely. And how we think about our leaders. I mean, do we think they're demigods? Do we love them? Or are we critical of them? But how are we critical of them? Do we say, they're all corrupt and bad? Or do we say, I wonder what the motivation behind this specific decision was? And that's how he would say to criticize a government.
And when you're you say you don't watch much TV, but if you're watching, you know, a debate or something like that on TV, are you saying that, borrowing from Machiavelli?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you say that's why this person said that. There's this lobby, there's this interest, there's this vote coming up, there's this political thing, there are foreign interests which have to be kept into account. This is complicated stuff. It's a shame that it's simplified. The speed of modern information has definitely made it harder for the complex analysis of politics, which was our tradition for a long time, which I would really call, I mean, many have called it before me, this Machiavellian tradition was based on complexity, learning, and thinking about this. It does get wiped away in the internet and iPhone age.
Well, I mean, it's almost invisible now. I mean, everything is rather knee-jerk.
That's right.
You know, immediate analysis, response. And I think in many ways the media, broadly speaking, is guilty of this.
I mean, I don't know what else to do. This is the way the web works. We're stuck with it. You know, we can complain about it all we want, but it's here. I sort of see universities. I know a lot of people feel negatively about them, and I've just, you know, talked about how hard it can be to go to school. But I think universities are one of these places you can sit for long periods of time and study things in detail, like politics, and start to understand this. And so I see them as deeply essential, universities and libraries, for sitting and thinking about politics and seeing how they work.
It would be interesting if Machiavelli, you know, was a pundit.
He tried and it didn't work out.
Oh, is that right?
Well, I mean, he had his opinions and he was a leader and he said what he thought and he got tortured and sent to his country house to write.
And that's how people felt about him in his time, because he was saying things perhaps that people believed but couldn't say out loud?
He defended the Republic. Right. And then afterwards, he was kept silent. His book was written in 1513, but it didn't come out until 1551 in print.
After his death.
So it's not clear that that book was meant to be published, but there were others, and he was a leading humanist scholar. People knew basically what he thought, and there were others thinking many of the same things at the time. And they were commenting on politics at the time, absolutely.
What do you hope your work does?
Right now, I hope it makes people think about politics in a more complex way. I hope it makes them more critical. I'm trying to write a book now for a bigger audience with Basic Books, which is a cool outfit because they want smart stuff that's for a bigger audience, and they help you do that. So translate this heady stuff into something people can understand. I think that's vital to communicate with people while not losing the research and the complexity of everything. And I hope that it makes people ask more questions and see where these problems come from so we can solve them. That sounds arrogant and ambitious, but if it does anything to start any kind of debate, and I feel like I make a difference with my students just doing that. You get 100 people a year, you make them ask more questions. I think that's already doing what I want to do.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Jacob Saul, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor of history at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey. His scholarly work focuses on the cultural and intellectual history of modern Europe, and he is one of those MacArthur fellows. The news came out last week, and he learned a couple of weeks earlier that he had received a very generous grant over the next 5 years, and that he is one of 22 winners this year, or recipients, say, a MacArthur Fellow. We're going to talk some more. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. And we'd love to hear from you. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Drexel University supports WHYY. If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in a research study called Project Well at Drexel University. This year-long weight loss study is sponsored by the National Institutes of Health and is designed to help adult participants lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. For more information, 215-762-1111, 215-762-1111.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Can the government attach a GPS tracking device to a car without first obtaining a warrant? Just one of the cases on the Supreme Court docket for the coming term. We'll have a preview. Also, choral music beyond glee. Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, a performance by the New York City-based group Red Bharat. This group has been gaining fans from around the world by melding North Indian Bhangra beats with an array of rhythms from funk and go-go to Latin and jazz. Beginning at 5:45, more details are available at philamuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Jacob Saul. We're talking about his passion for history. He is a professor of history at Rutgers University across the river here in Camden, New Jersey. As I said, a recipient of the so-called Genius Award this year. And the foundation praised his meticulous research into how modern governments came to be. We are both talking about his up and down experience as a student, what his work is about, and what he wants to do with this money. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You told me before we began that you actually haven't slept in about the last week or so, but it must, as someone who sort of toils in history and writes intellectual history, I would say. I read some of the pieces that you had in the back of the New Republic, a place where, you know, I think you have to be had your Wheaties that morning to make it through some of that stuff. And now to have this, and I don't mean to be crass about it, but this money to really pursue what you clearly are so passionate about.
I mean, it's
it must just change your whole head around.
Yeah, it changes everything. It's a title. Listen, it's something out of a movie. Why, you know, the Genius Grant hasn't been made yet as a movie. I really don't know because it's like something out of a movie. And to live it is crazy. I mean, I still wake up, and you know, they send you a piece of paper,
yes,
and I go out and see if it's there. The other night, I woke up and I Googled to see if it was real, because everything has changed, and it has changed right now for the better. I know lottery winners often do badly, but it's amazing, and for my work, it's so great. I just get to do it,
yeah,
and yeah, I'll have to argue about it, and people will still reject my papers, and I'll, you know, definitely get insulted, and that's fine. That's the business. But I get to go do it. As I told you, I'm going to move to Paris for a year. I'm going back to the libraries. I'm going to study. I'm going to read. I'm going to go to the Mediterranean. I'm going to have my books with me. I am going to drink a lot of wine. That's you know, it's true, and so it's great. This is a dream come true. I'm stunned. I have to write them a thank you note. You know, there's no email. It's all secretive, and so I have to get myself together to write a handwritten letter again, which I love doing, but it's been a while.
And how did they find out about you? Do you know that, or did someone nominate you? How does this work, or do you not know?
From what I can tell, because it's so secretive. Again, it's such a good story. That numerous people, I believe, have to nominate you, and they did tell me this briefly in the you know, moment of craziness when they called, that there were more than 100 accounts of, you know, letters or people that they talked to. I didn't fully,
about you
about me, so I didn't fully get that, but I sort of heard it in passing. So, and I know they told me it went on over years and years and years. So you're being watched, which is kind of weird.
Yes.
I mean, it's a good thing, you know, I didn't, you know, have some kind of arrest or something. You know what I mean? So
they right, your past is, as much as you were kicked out of high school, that didn't seem to be a problem for them.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And have you heard from any of those high school teachers that were tearing their hair out of over Jacob Saul?
I've heard from a lot of people. I've heard from a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. You love libraries.
I do.
I mean, old, musty, dusty libraries.
God, I love them.
And is that because that's where all the books are, or what?
Oh, I love them. Let me just say really straight out, you know, Philly is a great library city, and that's one of the reasons I like living here, besides my favorite restaurant, Bibu, is here. I have my restaurant, and I've got great libraries. That's why Franklin came here. Benjamin Franklin was a bookmaker, and not the kind that bets. I mean, he made books. He was a printer. He came here because there was a guy named, well, he came here to do his printing, but the biggest book collector in America was named James Logan, and he was here. He had 10,000 books, the collections at the Library Company. He was working with other book collectors and scholars. in Philly, and it was the book town in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And so the libraries formed. They're old-style European libraries. A lot of it's at the University of Pennsylvania, which is my lab. That's where I work with the people in the Rare Books Room who are wonderful. I mean, that's the best lab that I know, and I also work at Princeton. But this city was a book city. There are vestiges of that. There's an old library recreated in the Penn Library being remodeled right now. But the old libraries in Europe, they're magnificent, they're beautiful, and the only way to make these discoveries, you do some of it through the web, right. Absolutely. But this accounting project took off at the Rare Books Christmas party at Penn. I don't know if I'm supposed to allow to tell this story. We're drinking beer, and I had gone there feeling hopeless about my future and the next book, and I was with John Pollock, one of the Rare Books librarians, who's my good friend, and we're having a beer, and he said, "What are you working on? Like, how's it going? You know, how's this project going?" I said, "Oh God, you know, I don't know. It's not going so well." And he said, "Look, put down the beer. Let's go into the stacks. I think I might know something that will interest you." And so we go back in the stacks. It's like a sort of Indiana Jones moment. And he said, "No one's ever looked at these pamphlets from the French Revolution before, but you know, I know that they're here, and they have not been opened. I mean, I know that because the pages haven't been cut." And he said, "I had my eye on these just because I know they're here. I've had to catalog them. They might interest you." And within 10 minutes, I said, "That's it. That's it, the key. We broke the code. We found it. This is it. The project works." And had I not gone to the Christmas party and had the beer with John, right. I would not have this book. Right. I wouldn't understand it the way I understand it now.
That's a wonderful story, and it's such a person. I mean, you obviously have a very personal relationship with this librarian. And I'm also thinking about Google. You know, I mean,
sure.
you can type in things and just get over just a mountain of information. Sometimes it's hard to figure out how to traipse through all of that stuff. Or I don't know if you worry about TMI.
No. I mean, I don't worry. Well, I mean, I do because I have kids and, you know, I mean, I can't handle what I have to do. But no, you know what it's great for, is, believe it or not, is nerdy stuff like scholarly articles that you would have never found out about because who knew that journal even existed from 1925 and there's some reference that comes up. It is a great tracking source, but then you have to go actually do the hunting yourself by foot in the stacks. They're starting to get rid of stacks in libraries. When they do that, we're in big trouble for understanding our past.
Because you have to be there.
You have to be there. And what happens is you're looking for one book, and then four books down, you say, "Oh my gosh, you know, this book is from 1894. No one's ever referenced it." And you pull it off the shelf, and you say, "This is it." And that goes right home with you. You know, that's part of the process.
I feel a movie here. I do. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have David from Cinnaminson joining us on Radio Times. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for coming to talk to us today. My question is, if we look at the history of Europe, we can really see the we have these great texts that are representative of the dominant philosophical ideas at the time. Like we see the evolution and people come along like Hobbes and Locke and really define, you know, liberalism or republicanism. If you think you could extrapolate, what do you think the dominant ideas will be from the era that we're currently in? And if you could, even the text that you think really define those and put those into work, that people will look back 200 years from now and say, this is, you know, these are the thinkers that we can read and say, these were the dominant ideas or these were the emerging ideas in government.
David, I appreciate the call. And now I should say that we're talking with a professor of history, but nonetheless,
you must have thought
about this.
Well, it's a great question. I have thought about it. There's not an easy answer to that question. But the first answer would be, I don't think it's great philosophers. I often think it's the most skilled journalists. That's who politicians read now. I don't think they read enough political philosophy, but you know, everybody reads David Brooks whether they like him or not. And I have a funny feeling some of those books will be remembered. Some sort of definitive big history books or big philosophy books, Fukuyama's, now he's the guy that everyone talks about. Mm-hmm. That's not a Hobbesian book. I mean, that's not on that level. But I don't think those books represent reality. I love Hobbes, and I love Locke, and I love, you know, the Renaissance thinkers and the 18th century philosophers. I know how important they are, but they are the people writing these one-dimensional texts. I think it's much more complicated. So if someone says, look, free market is the way of things today. Well, we know, you know, how Boeing gets its contracts. It's not a totally free market system. We have a representative democracy where we're represented by, what, 90% millionaires. So the text can say one thing, but reality on the ground says something else. So the point is will we be remembered by ideas or complicated histories, which hopefully tell things in three dimension? I try and explain that to my students, and that's what I hope my work does, is you take the ideas and you take all these different building blocks around and try and put the puzzle together. It's harder to do than one would think, and I think it's going to be hard to define our age. It's moving quickly, and I don't think people necessarily know what's going on totally. Well, I don't. You know.
Well, that's interesting. David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Were there, though, complaints hundreds of years ago that there was too much information, that we just couldn't keep up with all the input that was coming our way?
Sure. My friend Ann Blair at Harvard's just written a big book called Too Much to Know, and it's about that. And there's always been a worry about this. The medieval scholars worried about it. They made compilations. There was, you know, too much glossary of Christian and Hebrew text. And so we've always dealt with this, and we seem to manage. It's getting harder, I know, in the sciences, because you have to master so much so quickly that scientists can get wiped out. My dad's a scientist, and he talks about that. I don't think there's too much to know. I think you can hack it. I actually think the web helps you zip through it more quickly if you can ride the beast and not get addicted to just following the stream.
Oh, sure. And it is very, very attractive out there. Let me see what Jen from Devon has to say. And Jen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Well, I wanted to ask MacArthur winner, that's kind of exciting, about the tradition emerging in your research and in present-day discourse of anti-intellectualism, and whether you see any trends in the politics that people who espouse anti-intellectualism, the kind of politics that they embrace. I feel that it sort of tends to go one way. People on different sides of the political spectrum maybe have different opinions about that. So I feel like there's maybe kind of a dodge about who owns anti-intellectualism and who uses it to their ends.
That's interesting, Jen. Yeah, go ahead, Jacob.
You know, one of the problems we struggle with in the university is actually criticizing ourselves. I feel like, you know, it's like one of those old cop movies where, like, you know, you don't betray the core, you know, the force. Because the fact is that when you want to know who is an anti-intellectual, one of the things people like to do is bash universities. You don't have to like your professor. Look, I said I didn't like all mine, you know, but universities are key. And that's the difference between dictatorships and democracies, is open, troublemaking, strange and complicated university systems. That's where the technology is coming out of. That is going to be the only basis of our economy in the future. That's the way it looks. I mean, it's going to have to be a technologically driven economy. When people start bashing universities, watch out for them. That's not good. It's anti-American. America was founded with its universities. Its founders were in those universities. John Adams was proud to have gone to Harvard. John Adams was a really important guy.
Jen, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And I also hear in her question a fear that we either have been or are an anti-intellectual country. And you can find plenty of evidence for that.
That's an old American tradition also, which goes to Harvard too, which has a great anti-intellectual tradition itself, with a great intellectual tradition. This is a paradox we struggle with in America. It's the anti-intellectual country to which all the intellectuals came this century. And so that worked, and it's still working. The other day we were at a meeting, and a lot of new faculty members were from other, even wealthy industrialized countries, and I nudged one of my colleagues, and I said, look, we're still poaching big brains. That's a good thing for the economy. That's what we need to be doing. So we do struggle with it, but right now the attack on higher education is baffling, since in the crisis, it was one of the only American industries which not only do we export, but which is recognized as the best all around the world in spite of all of its problems. This is an industry we want to support. This is an industry that makes money. We want to invest in it. And by the way, public education makes us richer. It always has, and it always will. It works. Remarkably, just to throw it around the aisle, the Republicans in Iowa have just raised higher education spending by 7%. I mean, but that's Iowa. Iowa is an unusual place, but it's a good model.
Well, indeed it is. And just if I can come full circle here, and one of the things that you talk about is keeping good books, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess keeping good books means being honest, right?
Yeah, with yourself. It's really rough. Yeah. Actually, just a note, ever since I got the prize and I knew I had more money,
yeah.
I haven't looked at my accounts in weeks. And I've been, you know, getting sushi and paying off my debts and bought my kids a turtle and a nice tank. You know what I mean? Whatever, living high, right? Went to Bibu, bought some wine. Right. But I'm going to have to face those books and manage this money eventually. But, yeah. Boy, that's kind of lame because that's hard. Then suddenly you realize you have to pay taxes. You got to spend a whole bunch on research. Once you pay your debts and look at your mortgage, it's actually you don't have any money left. That's a hard thing to do. Yeah. So it's not just honesty. It's also self-discipline, and this is what the medieval and Renaissance accounting writers would say. And so this was part of scholarship, too. A huge amount of personal discipline of taking notes. The scholars did it, and accountants did it, and they both kept books.
So you don't feel rich?
I feel a lot richer than I was, I can tell you that. But I mean, you know, by the way, I haven't gotten a cent yet, so, you know, I've got like $800 in my account, so, you know. Anyway.
But do you find people saying... You know, my new best friend, Jacob Saul, and...
Actually, a lot of people... This is an American thing. A lot of people bought me a lot of great drinks. And by the way, a thank you goes out there for everyone who's bought me fantastic wine and booze. I really appreciate that. But then everyone's punctuating that with, you know, you're buying the next round.
Oh, there you go. Well, it's been such a pleasure. I congratulate you once again. And Jacob Saul, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, a professor of history at Rutgers University in Camden. His scholarly work focuses on the cultural and intellectual history of modern Europe and one of this year's MacArthur Fellows. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page, you can find out what Jacob Saul looks like. I'm Marty Moscoyne. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.